There is a difference between relief and stimulus, and the way people are using their checks from the government kind of drives that home. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott, in for Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday, April 7th. Good to have you with us. The Federal Reserve Bank of New York is out with a new study today looking at how people are spending or not spending their pandemic relief checks. So far, most are using the money to pay off debt or saving it, not exactly the economic stimulus many are hoping for. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has more on why people are holding back on spending.
The New York Fed says the consumers it surveyed who've already received their third relief checks are hanging on to the money, just like they did with the first and second relief payments. The Fed report says consumers are only planning to spend a quarter of the most recent check, and most of that will go toward essentials.
We're savers.
Jason Calazar is an eighth grade teacher. He, his wife, and teenage son live near Los Angeles. He says in the before times, they'd go out to eat once or twice a month. But they won't be using any of their stimulus money for that. In fact, he doesn't think they'll set foot in a restaurant until next year.
We've spent the better part of 13 months just avoiding indoors and people or strangers, and then it would just be a big hurdle to get over.
Calazar says they might reconsider once they're all vaccinated. Kathy Bosjancic, an economist at Oxford Economics, says a lot of other consumers feel the same way.
The confidence to go out and spend on services is very directly related to the progress we're making on the vaccinations.
Bosjancic thinks we'll make enough progress for consumer spending to jump about 3.5% over the next few months. Other economists, like Joseph Minerick of the Conference Board, aren't quite so optimistic.
The people who worked in hotels or in transportation, where getting up to full capacity is going to take some time, those folks are going to continue to hold back in terms of their spending.
Minerick says even some people who do have jobs are worried they'll get a pink slip, and economic growth won't recover without them, since roughly 70% of the U.S. economy is consumer spending. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
There's an industry term for people who don't have a checking or savings account, the unbanked. More than 7 million Americans fall into that category, according to the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. And one consequence of that is not having a place to deposit those federal relief payments Nancy was talking about. Now the FDIC has launched a public campaign aimed at changing that. Marketplace's Justin Ho reports.
Households that are unbanked tend to have lower incomes, more volatile incomes, less education. Leonard Chain is deputy to the chairman of the FDIC. He says 2.5% of white households are unbanked.
And that's in contrast to about 14% of African American households and about 12% of Hispanic households who are unbanked.
There are plenty of reasons why disadvantaged communities might avoid the banking system.
You may have immigrant communities where people come from countries where they can't trust the banking system like you can in the U.S.
Robert James II is the chairman of the National Bankers Association, which represents minority lenders.
You may have situations in the U.S. where, you know, people come from communities that have historically been underserved or been preyed upon by the banking system.
Some minority-owned lenders have been trying to overcome that historical hesitation. Dominic Miartan runs Optus Bank, a Black-owned lender in South Carolina. It offers a checking account with no minimum opening balance and no fee if users keep at least $100 in it.
We have intentionally designed that account to be very simple, very transparent, very easy to use.
Through its campaign, the FDIC is trying to let unbanked people know all of the advantages of opening a bank account. Leonard Chainin with the FDIC says instead of taking a check to a check cashing service, paying a fee, then walking around with a bunch of cash,
the funds are going to be in an insured account as opposed to a check coming in your mailbox or even a prepaid card coming in your mailbox.
Plus, he says you have access to funds right away to transfer around or pay bills. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, there were ups, there were downs. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. President Joe Biden was on the stump for his $2.3 trillion infrastructure plan today. In a speech at the White House this afternoon, Biden defended a proposed corporate tax increase to help pay for the plan. Biden wants to raise the tax rate on corporations from 21% to 28%, though he said today he's willing to negotiate on the exact amount. Opponents of the idea say it could create even more incentive for companies to shift their profits to countries with lower tax rates. And to fight that, the Biden administration has come out in support of a global minimum tax for corporations. So this kind of gaming of the system doesn't keep happening. Marketplace's Marielle Segura reports.
This gaming of the system, it's not great for countries like the U.S., but it works for the tax havens, places like the Cayman Islands. Terrence Corvat is an international law professor at George Mason University.
Their argument is that they don't have as developed an infrastructure, or they're not in the center of transportation networks or other things. And so they charge a lower rate in order to attract businesses.
But that creates what many policymakers here have called a race to the bottom. Steve Rosenthal is a senior fellow at the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center.
The countries compete with each other to lower tax rates to attract more corporations.
So the OECD is trying to strike a deal that would make this kind of profit-shifting maneuver much harder. Countries would agree to a minimum tax rate for foreign corporate subsidiaries. And I won't get into the weeds here, but Rosenthal says in the plan, there are ways the U.S. and the OECD are trying to push all countries to participate.
And the consequences of not participating could be large enough that they would go along, at least to some extent.
But there are more than 50 countries that are not even at the negotiating table for this deal. Lillian Fallhaber is a law professor at Georgetown.
So there remains a question as to whether or not there could still be tax competition with other countries still imposing lower rates of tax.
But she says the OECD is getting a lot closer to a deal than any other group has. I'm Marielle Segura for Marketplace.
And your daily reminder that David Brancaccio and the team will be up early tomorrow to make sure you have the economic context you need. Catch them each day on the Marketplace Morning Report. We know this pandemic has hit some groups harder than others. Latinx people have been hospitalized with COVID at three times the rate of white people, the CDC says, and have died at more than twice the rate. Many perform essential jobs in agriculture and food processing, for instance, where there have been big outbreaks of COVID. And even now that the country is getting vaccinated at a rapid pace, the disparity persists. The Latinx population is getting those vaccines more slowly than other Americans. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports now from one of Washington State's most productive farming regions.
Outside the city of Yakima, orchards and fruit packing warehouses line the dusty highways. In the city, mobile homes are packed into neighborhoods where bodegas advertise tacos and Mexican sweets. For the past several weeks, the city's convention center has turned into a COVID vaccination center. 78-year-old Angelina Gallegos was waiting in line.
I came to get my vaccine. It's a blessing from God.
Her son, who works in the fields, got COVID last year.
My son Tino was put in the hospital. It started with a high fever, swelling, and his throat was badly infected.
The Yakima Valley Farm Workers Clinic operates the vaccination site. Nurse Lori Kelly is a director of the clinic, which serves low-income, predominantly Latinx communities in Washington and Oregon.
In the beginning of the vaccination efforts, we did have challenges with receiving vaccine.
She says local essential workers in food processing and agriculture had to wait for months to be vaccinated, even though they've suffered high rates of COVID illness and death. Kelly says vaccination is now picking up, and the clinic is now receiving more vaccine doses through a federal program for safety net community health centers.
So that collaboration with our states has allowed us to have a steady supply of vaccines. Sometimes the only vaccine we receive in a given week to provide to our communities.
But there is still a long way to go, says Samantha Artiga at the Kaiser Family Foundation.
Hispanic people are receiving smaller shares of vaccinations relative to their shares of cases, deaths, and total population.
In Washington, just 7% of people who've been vaccinated are Latinx, though they make up 13% of the state's population. Part of the reason may be that more white residents are elderly and qualified earlier. But Artiga says there are other reasons for the low Latinx vaccination rate: lack of transportation, language barriers, and
they are less likely to be connected to a healthcare provider because they are more likely to be uninsured.
Knowing the vaccine was free and didn't require insurance helped convince Julieta Pulido to get vaccinated at her local clinic. She's 32 and works in a fruit packing warehouse where dozens of workers got sick last year, prompting a walkout.
It hit home. One of my close friends, she got COVID. You know, it was scary because I was sitting next to her all the time.
Pulido was pregnant at the time. Now she has a 5-month-old, another reason to get vaccinated.
And I have to be healthy and safe for her. If it's available, why not take it?
¿Me puede dar la fecha de nacimiento, por favor?
Lori Kelly at the Yakima Valley Farm Workers Clinic says with spring here, the fields and packing plants are about to get very busy. And so is her organization.
We have worked with some of our agricultural growers to offer on-site vaccinations for their employees. And thus far, we have seen that those workers are very interested in getting the vaccine.
Meanwhile, FEMA, state and local health departments, and the city's main hospital have just opened a mass drive-through vaccination center at the county fairgrounds. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Coming up,
Easter bath bombs and jelly beans and a lot of little trinkets.
Sounds like someone had a good holiday. But first, let's do the numbers. Not much of a swing, really. The Dow Jones Industrial Average banked 16 points, not even a tenth of a percent, to finish at 33,446. The NASDAQ dropped 9 points, again, not even a tenth of a percent, to end at 13,688. And the S&P 500 added 6 points, more than a tenth of a percent, to land at 4079. $199.99 a year is how much Best Buy is hoping its customers will be willing to pay for a subscription program offering discounts, free delivery, and tech support. Best Buy company lost a tenth of a percent. Walmart, which runs its own subscription service, lost 0.2%. And Amazon, which of course pioneered the subscription model, picked up 1.7%. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note is 1.67%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Amy Scott. The city of Evanston, Illinois, just outside Chicago, recently became the first U.S. city to approve a reparations program for its black residents. Focused on home ownership, the program will give eligible Evanstonians up to $25,000 for down payments, mortgage assistance, or home improvement. The goal is to help close the racial wealth gap created by decades of housing discrimination. Alderman Robin Rue Simmons is the driving force behind this plan. She first proposed it back in 2019. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
One of the questions that comes up when we talk about reparations is, you know, how do you determine who has suffered and who is, quote, deserving of reparations? How did you decide that question when it came to Evanston's program?
So in our case, residents that lived here between 1919 and 1969 and are black have received an injury on behalf of the city of Evanston because they were limited to live in one particular part of the community. And their direct descendants, of course, are injured because there was no opportunity to transfer down wealth that their elders were not able to access. And then obviously those that have experienced direct discrimination, housing discrimination, because they're Black would qualify. But we're starting with a tier system. And those that were directly injured and qualified, that if they want to pass along their benefit to a direct descendant, that's an option that they have. And I thought that was important, so that if that elder is in a place in life where they are not owning or have no intentions of owning a home at the stage in their life, they can at least pass that opportunity of wealth down to their child or their grandchild.
And why did you choose housing specifically as a way to address some of the wrongs that Black Evanstonians have dealt with?
Well, appropriately, the community prioritized housing. Reparations work is important, that is led by the injured community, in this case, the Black community. So through a series of public meetings with stakeholders and community members in 2019, we asked three simple questions. What forms of reparations would you like us to prioritize? How might we fund it, and who should qualify? And the consensus of that feedback was housing. And so we are moving forward with housing. We all know that it's the most likely path to building wealth. But in our case, the injury was so specific and targeted to the Black community. It included housing and zoning policies from 1919 to 1969 that restricted the Black community to living in one corridor of our city. And that same corridor was intentionally disinvested in and disenfranchised. And so it stripped away opportunities for wealth and limiting the area in which we could live in.
And that's your ward, the Fifth Ward, right?
That is my ward. It's my where I was born and raised, in the West End of the Fifth Ward. I've raised my children here. The Black community has a $46,000 less of a household income on average than our white friends and neighbors here in Evanston. We have 13 years less life expectancy. We have an achievement gap and an opportunity divide. And it was important that we do something tangible that we could measure that was working in the direction of bridging our racial divide.
The one alderman who voted against the program thought it was too restrictive, that people should be given perhaps cash and decide how they want to spend it. What's your response to that?
My immediate response is we have more work to do. This isn't a settlement. We have only allocated the first 4% of our program. But really what we should be doing is looking at how we can grow the fund. It's initially $10 million. We should be looking at how do we grow that fund to $100 million in Evanston so that we can really dig in deep and make sure that we are delivering a reparative initiative to the Black residents of Evanston.
The larger conversation about reparations has been in and out of the headlines for decades. A version of a bill that's now in the House, H.R. 40, was first proposed in 1989. Do you think this time is different when it comes to reparations at the federal level?
It's absolutely different right now. There is more of a heart. There's more of an appetite. It's unfortunate that it's taken social media and more racial terror and police terror and more financial devastation to acknowledge with some action the anti-Blackness in this nation. But we're here now. There is no more data or study that is needed. The information is right in your face. And at this moment in history, we are very, very near a day that we will see federal reparations, I believe. And then the work is very difficult. I'm speaking from experience in Evanston. It's taken us from 2019 until just a week ago to advance our first initiative. And so my encouragement to our federal leaders is that we begin the work now. There's a lifetime, there's two lifetimes of work ahead of us. And we begin the work now, understanding that it's going to be incremental, but acknowledging that it is necessary. It is justice. It's overdue. And my hope is that the work will continue.
Robin Rue Simmons is alderman of the Fifth Ward in the city of Evanston, Illinois. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Nancy Marshall-Genzer was talking up at the top of the show about when consumer spending might pick back up to pre-pandemic levels. There's the macro view of the economy, and then there's what retailers are seeing firsthand. So for this installment of our series, My Economy, we called up a toy shop owner who normally relies on a steady business before Easter to see how the holiday went for her this year.
I'm Irene Kesselman, and I own Alley Cat Toys in Carrboro, North Carolina. My Easter retail season was terrific. We were up last month for the first time in several months. We probably made over 50 Easter baskets. It's a lot of stuffed bunnies and rabbits and lambs. But we also had a lot of little things too, like Easter bath bombs and some Easter jelly beans and a lot of little trinkets that we have readily available in the store. We offered private shopping appointments. We didn't have as many as we did at Christmas time. However, we really felt a lot of the people were ready to come out. In fact, one customer in particular, when my employee handed her her bag, I think she said, you know, she was just so pleased that we were still around and that we were able to, you know, forge ahead during these times. And we saw a lot of that. I think we could feel it. We saw more grandparents come out, and they felt, I think, more at ease. We saw parents with their kids, which we hadn't seen a lot of the kids in months. And clearly in a toy store, we're used to seeing kids daily. It felt really wonderful. For the first time in many, many years, we had closed during, I think, February on Sundays for a few weeks, which we had never done before. So far, April is off to a good start. And when the Easter holiday falls on an early day, as it did this time, you're always a little bit uncertain as to how the business is going to go. Clearly, in retail, if Easter is the second or third week of April, you have more time to sell. So we didn't have that this year, but we're still seeing in the few days that we've had in April, we're seeing the continuity of people coming in and wanting to touch and feel things and buy a present for a newborn, or, you know, now we're selling a lot of outdoor toys. And we just hope this transition continues because it feels great.
Irene Kesselman of Alley Cat Toys in Carrboro, North Carolina. This series only works with your help. Let us know how your economy is doing at marketplace.org/myeconomy. This final note on the way out, I confess I missed this one yesterday, and I kind of wish it had stayed that way. The number of billionaires in the world, according to the latest count from Forbes, grew by 30% in the past year to a record 2,755. That's almost 500 new billionaires during a global pandemic, when the UN estimates the world economy lost the equivalent of more than 250 million jobs. A lot of that new wealth is in stock, of course. And to paraphrase a certain Kai Rizdahl, the stock market and the economy, not the same thing. And your moment of economic context on a Wednesday, we talked about how people are using their relief checks to save and spend down debt, while consumers overall are borrowing more, too. The Federal Reserve said today that after dipping slightly at the beginning of the year, consumer credit increased at an annual rate of almost 8% in the month of February. Revolving credit, including credit cards, was up 10%. Our media production team includes Brian Allison, Robin Edgar, Drew Jostad, Garrett Lang, Jeff Peters, Jay Siebold, Liana Squillaci, Charlton Thorpe, Ben Tolliday, and Becca Weinman. I'm Amy Scott. We'll see you tomorrow. This is APM.